Connect Learning to Life with our host, Robin Hiller, is an educational show to break down the realities facing it today and discuss how the future can be geared to meet every student's lifelong needs. Join us as we navigate these issues on 1030 The Voice.
Good afternoon, Pima County. This is Connect Learning to Life. I am hosting today in for Robin Hiller, who is out. I want to thank her for last week. I've got my co-host here with me, Nathan Bacall. Nathan, say hello.
Hello. Hope everyone's doing well today.
Good. We are doing Connect Learning to Life every Saturday between 4 to 5. Tune in, and we have a great guest and lineup for you today. We have Lauren Lombardo, who's a teacher from TUSD. And we have Dave Wells, Grand Canyon Institute. And we also have Justin Williams, no relation to me, Dustin Williams, who's going to talk about CivX. So we're going to start with Lauren. We got Lauren on the line. Lauren, are you available?
I'm here.
Well, Lauren, first of all, you're an educator, and we want to thank you for the amazing job that you're doing out there, especially with this new fun thing called COVID-19. Now, tell us real quick, where do you teach and what grade?
I teach second grade at Cowand Elementary.
Okay, and what district there?
In Tucson Unified School District.
How long have you been teaching?
This is my third year teaching.
Okay.
I'm still pretty new.
All right, and where'd you graduate from?
U of A in 2018.
So obviously, the last couple years, you were doing it little second graders in class and had them all in there, and now the experience is a little bit different, correct?
Yes, it's much different than the classroom has ever looked.
So, Lauren, tell me, walk us through a regular day of what it's like. Are you in the classroom right now, or are you teaching remotely?
No, so we all teach remotely from home. No one in our school is on site.
Okay, so the entire district for TUSD is all at home right now.
Yes, for the most part. Well, so we do have support staff in a few schools. Our school is a learning hub, so we have students who might be at risk of falling behind. They're able to come to school and be monitored by monitors or other support staff at the school site.
Gotcha. So I'm obviously a father of two boys, so we get to watch a little bit of it both ways. We have what's called the hybrid or the blend, so they go a couple days a week, and then the other days they're doing their remote. Walk us through a typical day. What does a day look like from start to finish with this remote learning?
So for my class, typically we start our day at 9:15, which is when our school normally starts. We meet together on Zoom for maybe about 45 minutes, and depending on what day of the week it is, we have, you know, little prompts. So on Monday, we talk about, like, our feelings and how the week went and what's going on ahead, calendar, that kind of stuff. You know, sometimes we do math, journals, those kinds of things. And then we take a break because we really can only have them on synchronous learning with us in the lower grades, K-2, for 30 minutes at a time. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's pretty difficult. So they take a little break, do whatever work they were assigned in the morning, and then we come back on at 10:30, and we usually do math in my classroom for about another 30, 45 minutes. They sometimes are able to work with a partner in breakout rooms on Zoom, or sometimes we just kind of all work together, and there's a lot of whiteboard work or using whatever manipulative they have available at home. And then they go offline, and they do whatever work they were assigned. Then they take a lunch break. They're assigned some independent reading, independent work for a little bit, and then we usually come back again in the afternoon, same rundown for language arts. Sometimes we, you know, read together, we talk about writing, but it's just so much different than what it would have been like in the classroom. And that's, you know, the end of our day. They come on and off, and they do have to do their work independently without any support from me. I'm there if they need me, but you know, they have, usually their parent can call or text me. They're like, hey, can you get back on Zoom? And then we can run through it. But it's, you know, it's a bit more of a concerted effort.
Yes, it takes a village, correct, for this to work, actually.
Yes,
let me ask you something, Lauren. So these are little second graders. When you had them in the classroom before, how many were in your classroom when it was live?
I typically had anywhere from 19 to 24.
Okay, and so right now when you're in the remote scenario, how many are on your roster?
I have 19 right now, and I'm pretty lucky because almost all of my kids log on every single day for every single meeting. There's like, you know, a couple kids who sometimes they miss the first meeting or they'll miss the afternoon meeting because they're, you know, involved in their other specials, like if they have speech or ex-ed resource rooms, or if they work with the ELL teacher, sometimes they have to miss our sessions because they're with those teachers.
And what about the technology aspects as well? So for you as a teacher, you had the board, you had the manipulatives, you had everything in the classroom. Now everything went to technology. So how challenging was that for you?
It is incredibly challenging, especially for things like typing. You know, these are second graders. A lot of the time, they weren't using computers. You know, they would use them here and there, but they weren't familiar with typing. They were just learning how to read and how to write big, long sentences. And so for that to have been transitioned to working on the computer when most of them have never typed before, it's hard. And then, you know, we get a lot of parents who want to help, and so sometimes they dictate. The kids dictate, and then the parents will type for them, but that's not, you know, you're not seeing what a second grader can do. You're seeing what an adult can do. And so that's become a lot more challenging to grade their work.
And what about the technology aspects? I mean, it's probably the most frustrating thing in the world when a computer doesn't work or you get the bad connection. How often, and what, I mean, be real, how often does that technology issue happen for not just yourself, but with the students as well?
A lot. It happens, I mean, probably once or twice a week I have a parent texting me and saying, like, hey, we're having trouble getting on, or, you know, the Zoom is down, or this program's not working correctly. And that's just, you know, for their asynchronous work. But, I mean, for our own class, like, there's a lag sometimes, or sometimes if, you know, whatever internet provider you have, if they go down, everybody's offline. You know, you don't have to suddenly adjust your lesson. You're like, hey, guys, my internet's down. I'm really sorry. We'll try this again at our next meeting. And there's really nothing we can do. And you know, that's not, it's not ideal.
And for second graders especially, trying to understand that obviously has got to be an incredible challenge.
Well, and I mean, they get frustrated sometimes. And like sometimes there's issues with, oh, my microphone's not working, or I can't hear you, or I can't see everybody. And so they're not able to participate. And if they're fortunate enough to have a parent or somebody there to help them right at that moment, it's great. But sometimes they're like, my dad's working right now, or my brother, you know, I'm at home with my sibling and they're in their own class. They can't help me. And they don't have anybody to help them there, you know, and you can't really walk a second grader through, okay, well, do you try this? Have you tried that? Like, it's just so much.
Yeah.
It's hard for them and they get discouraged.
And so in a regular day, when you had the kids in the classroom and you had these type of challenges, they're so different. You could sit with the student, you could talk with them. What about that social emotional part? We hear a lot about in this new remote age, how are the kids doing? How do you feel that the social emotional aspects for kids are going, and what do you see as the challenges there?
Well, it's really hard because they don't have a lot of organic time just to interact like kids would. You know, there's not a lot of room for in our day because we can't have Zoom sessions longer than we're able to, like 30 to 45 minutes. And so they don't really, like, you know, we teach our lesson, we work a little bit together, get some practice in, and then they have to go because we can't ask them to be on longer than that. And so they're really missing out on just organic conversations or things flowing naturally because they have to unmute themselves. And then, you know, we can't go off on tangents maybe like we could in another, you know, just in a normal classroom.
Yeah.
And so they really miss each other. And I try to put them in breakout rooms and, you know, let them work together. But at the same time, it's not the same as, you know, okay, go work with your partner and I'll circulate around because, you know, I have to come into the breakout room and then leave the breakout room. And I have no idea really what's happening or if they're being productive while they're in there when I'm not physically in there.
It's so interesting to have this conversation with you right now. And to the listeners out there, we're talking about second graders and putting them in Zoom breakout rooms. And is that what you guys use? Do you use Zoom? Is that the platform?
Yes.
And how
do you use Zoom?
How do you make sure that's like secure and stuff? Because I've heard those things get hacked into at times. And
right. So our district actually did this really great thing where at the beginning of the pandemic schooling, anybody could log on to Zoom. As long as you had a Zoom login and you had the teacher's meeting ID, you could come into the classroom because some kids were coming in on phones and some kids were coming in at their parents' workplace. But now they really secured our access point. So if the kids need to have a TUSD email address, so every kid has their matriculation number and an email address, and that's the only way you can gain access is if you have one of these, an authenticated user account, I guess you would call it.
Wow.
And so other than that, nobody else can come in.
Oh, that's Nathan, that's just so much stuff there, right? I mean,
right.
let me ask you something, Laura, on the other side. We talk about the social emotional for the kids. Let's talk a little bit about how about the social emotional for the teachers? Like, how are you guys feeling with all of this new pressure and challenge?
Isolated. To be perfectly honest. This is my first year teaching second grade. I've taught third grade for the past 2 years, and I stepped down because we had such a huge cohort of kids. And so, you know, this is a new year for me. I've never taught this curriculum. And so my teammates are amazing. And, you know, I knew them. They were my hallmates before. But to not be able just to pop in and be like, hey, like, my kids are having trouble with this math lesson, or how are you teaching this? Or, hey, do you have something I could borrow to teach long E? You know, because we all have to pull our resources so far in advance and plan together in order to send out packets, that there is none of this like, well, hey, this isn't working. Can I try something that you have, like we would do in a normal school year? Because, I mean, there's no way to anticipate how kids are going to adopt information, wow. I guess you would say. And so, you know, it's isolating, to be perfectly honest. Like, and then we meet together as a team, but you're a little bit burnt out on Zoom, and so it's not the funnest to be with each other.
Well, you know, and it's funny you say that, because we always talk that, you know, kids these days have too much screen time, and now here we are all day long on there. Let me ask you this too. We have obviously other teachers in different districts that are doing the hybrid or the blend, and we actually have some districts that are full-time in person. Just personally, how do you feel? Would you like to be in a hybrid model or in person, or do you feel like you want to stay in this remote option?
I mean, for safety wise, I completely understand why we're doing it, but I miss my kids, you know, and I have kids of my own, and I see how hard they're struggling, to be out of the classroom, you know? And so I would love to be able to go back, but I know that our district making the best choices for us right now is in terms of like what's safe and what's going to keep the kids healthy.
And you guys were kind of going back and forth there for a second. They were going to open, and then they were going to close, and then they were going to open again. What? How did that draw on you? How was that for your psychological standpoint?
it was hard, you know, because there wasn't enough preparation time, but just to be in limbo like that. And I guess that's a little bit how we were in the beginning of the year. Are we going to open? Are we not going to open? Are we going to be hybrid? What's going to happen? It's just maybe more mentally taxing, because, you know, you spend all this time preparing. You're like, okay, I can do this. And once you wrap your head around it, you know, you really can. But to not know is, I think, more tiring a little bit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's draining.
Absolutely. What is a message that you have for parents out there right now and how to deal through this? What do you say to them?
I tell this to my parents all the time. I'm like, be kind to yourselves, because I mean, I'm a teacher and I don't feel like I'm equipped to teach my fifth graders at home. You know, I can't imagine balancing a job that wasn't teaching related and having to work full time. So, you know, be kind to yourselves. And if your kid is having a rough day, just communicate with your teacher. Be like, hey, I know this is really important, but my son or daughter is having a really hard time. Can we skip Zoom and do the asynchronous work? And like, just to know that you have that option, as long as you're communicating, is such a relief.
That's
like,
that
communicate.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, that's such good advice. Lauren, you are a amazing woman. We are so, so thankful for what you're doing in this community. Just thank you from the bottom of our hearts in this county for what you're doing out there. Hang in there, keep up the excellent work, and thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, you take care and be good. That was Lauren Lombardo, teacher, TUSD, second grade. You are listening to Connect Learning to Life.
Politics too often overrides sound policy decisions, and you pay the consequences. The Grand Canyon Institute, a centrist think tank, uses the power of independent thinking to rise above the political fray and subject policy ideas to economic analysis. The Grand Canyon Institute provides high-quality independent research to advance solutions to Arizona's biggest problems, whether it be education, water, tax policy, healthcare, or jobs. Check out the Institute at GrandCanyonInstitute.org. Read our policy reports, join our email list, or donate.
Hi, my name is Jim Hanley. I was born and raised in Tucson, and I raised my own boys here. I want to get to know you, your dreams and goals, and help you shape them into a plan for success. I've been helping hundreds of Tucson families do this since 1993. It takes experience and know-how to navigate the rocky shoals of the financial markets and keep you on an even keel. I look at every account I manage every day to find opportunities to grow your nest egg, to make you at ease and enjoying your life. I want to show you the highest integrity and reliability you can find anywhere. That's why I named my business with my own name, Jim Hanley LLC, and why I'm a member of the CFA Society of Tucson. Find me at jimhanleyllc.com or call me at 623-3646. That's 623-3646. Jim Hanley LLC is a registered investment advisor and a member of FINRA SIPC.
That's the jam right there. Well, KP McCounty, we are back. Good afternoon on a gorgeous day. I hope everybody is wearing their mask, washing their hands, and practicing their social distancing. Nathan, do you practice your social distancing?
As much as possible, 6 feet or more.
Okay, and you wear a mask?
Every day, every time I'm out.
Yeah, we need to figure out. That was Lauren. We thank her again for being on the show. We've got another guest here on Connect Learning to Life. His name is Dave Wells. He's a professor at ASU. He also works with the Grand Canyon Institute. So let's hear a little bit from Dave. Dave, are you on with us right now?
Yeah, and I'm doing good on the social distancing. I'm keeping you about 100 miles away.
Well, that's going to be about as safe as we can possibly get. Dave, do you practice all the safe stuff? You got the mask and the hand sanitizer and the social distancing?
Yeah, I've even invested in a variety of different masks. I can, so I was wearing my John Lewis mask today when I was going to the Produce on Wheels, which they have it out in Tucson too.
You can
spend $12 and get 70 pounds of produce.
There you go. Well, where's that
on
at?
A bike.
Okay.
Well, they have different places, but yeah, people can look it up, the Produce on Wheels. They have both places in Tucson and up here in the Phoenix area. And I'm one of the few people who goes there on my bike with a trailer to get the produce.
Yeah, we have that. My neighbor does that, and she'll come over and bring all sorts of zucchini and tomatoes and all sorts of stuff. Hey, let's get into this. Tell us, so I said that correct, right? ASU professor and Grand Canyon Institute?
Right.
So explain, I think we all know kind of the professor at a college level, but for the listeners out there, what exactly is the Grand Canyon Institute?
So the Grand Canyon Institute is a think tank. It was co-founded by myself and George Cunningham, who you probably know from in the Tucson area. And it was designed to help elevate the sort of an evidence-based evaluation of public policy in the state, as opposed to too often our public policy in the state has been purely driven by ideology, and we try to evaluate things and make that known to both the public and as well as policymakers to try to improve that.
Well, we had a pretty nice election for some people and others maybe not, but there's definitely going to be some big change in this country. Along with that election here in Arizona, there was a proposition for listeners out there called Proposition 208. Why don't you tell us a little bit about 208?
Yeah, so I'm sure your listeners are well aware of Prop 208, Invest in Ed. And so we did an analysis, because there were multiple analyses of Prop 208. What was different about our analyses is, A, it was independent, and B, it was the only one that looked at both sides of the equation. So if you looked at the various analyses that the Arizona Chamber put together, you'd find that they made no analysis of how it might impact education in a positive way. They only looked at what they saw were negative tax impacts. And the analyses that the campaign put out from Prop 208 generally all emphasized education and sort of ignored the tax impact. So we're the only ones that looked at both sides, which is what we tried to do. We did that the same way with the minimum wage initiative in 2016. And to try to help people, you know, see sort of the aspects of both ends of it. And we don't take an official position on it. We let people sort of look at our estimates and see where that might help them make a decision.
Now, do you know the statistics of what it won by, what the percentage was?
I think it's about 52-48
Okay.
percent. Yeah.
And this isn't the first time that this tried to go through, correct?
No, it's not. So there was an effort. Of course, you know, we had an amazing organization of teachers with Red for Ed in 2018, and they were able to, you know, the 50,000 teachers down at the Capitol, and ultimately, you know, that led to Governor Ducey in his reelection year coming up with the 20 by 2020 plan, which was an effort to increase teacher salaries by approximately 20% over a three-year period, because we have had a significant, teachers aren't paid very well, and our class sizes are really big compared to other states. And on top of that, there's an inadequate ability to fill positions, which causes, you know, lots of other issues, because you want to have the best possible teacher you can for kids. So that was sort of like a beginning thing. It had a whole many of other demands, but they weren't put forward. So this, the Invest in Ed was put forward as a ballot proposition in 2018, and it was thrown off the ballot by the Supreme Court based on a technicality. I think there were two pieces of it that they might have, but the main thing was that they had one word where they used percentage instead of percent, and that, along with, I think, leaving out one thing in the description, were the reasons that they threw it out. And as a consequence, they had to try it again this year. And this was, of course, really even harder because of the pandemic, made it much more difficult for any initiative to get the signatures. A number of initiatives weren't able to do that because they went through the Ninth Circuit and to try to get the federal government, as well as through the state Supreme Court, to try to get permission to use the way in which candidates who run for statewide office can have people sign online petitions. That would have been a lot safer. But anyway, the courts decided that that was not permissible for initiatives. And as a consequence, they had to still go door to door or whatever they had to do to try to get the signatures.
Now, that was some hardship for 2-8. But it also had another little hardship right before. Didn't something happen just this go-around also where it almost didn't get on the ballot again?
Yeah, well, they tried, you know, I think it's a 100-word summary that they tried to do. Yeah, I mean, there's an effort to, because, you know, it's a lot easier to get something. If you can get something thrown off the ballot, it's a lot cheaper if you're opposing an initiative than to have to spend all the money to try to oppose it. And an initiative like this one is going to be a challenging one to defeat because, you know, it's focused on taxing wealthy people and providing money for education. So they were trying to throw it off the ballot. This time around, I think the primary objection related to the 100-word summary and whether or not it was accurate or not. Unfortunately, in this case, they said that was not an issue with this particular initiative, which is good, because we can't have the goal of these things is to actually have people evaluate them and vote on them, not have them have the courts intercede all the time and throw them off.
And with this proposition, you mentioned something about money. How much money actually does this proposition going to bring to state of Arizona in education?
Well, I think in the short run, it's not going to bring as much as people would like, because it's a tax that basically affects the sort of top 1%. Doesn't affect a lot of people who voted on it, because you have to have a single income that's taxable of at least $250,000 before the tax goes into place, and you pay an extra 3.5% or 3.5 cents on the dollar for every dollar of taxable income above $250,000. And if you're filing jointly or head of household, the taxable cutoff is $500,000. So you have to earn more than $500,000. So it's a relatively small percentage. We expect that about 30,000 households will actually have to pay the tax. So the initiative proponents had thought it would probably bring in about $940 million. The Joint Legislative Budget Committee said it's probably going to be closer to $840. And the thing is, with COVID going on and the economy being depressed right now, it's a little bit hard to do. We used the Joint Legislative Budget Committee's estimate because we wanted to be more conservative, but it's even possible that that might be a little bit on the high side, depending on what's going on, because our COVID numbers are going up throughout the country, and you don't really know where we're going to be.
It's going to be interesting. Dave, I want you to stay. Can you stay in the line for a little bit longer? I want to kind of get into a little bit more of the 208, but then get into some stuff about the university.
Sure.
Okay, great. Listeners, stay with us. We're here. Connect learning to life.
Hi, my name is Jim Hanley. I was born and raised in Tucson, and I raised my own boys here. I want to get to know you, your dreams and goals, and help you shape them into a plan for success. I've been helping hundreds of Tucson families do this since 1993. It takes experience and know-how to navigate the rocky shoals of the financial markets and keep you on an even keel. I look at every account I manage every day to find opportunities to grow your nest egg, to make you at ease and enjoying your life. I want to show you the highest integrity and reliability you can find anywhere. That's why I named my business with my own name, Jim Hanley LLC, and why I'm a member of the CFA Society of Tucson. Find me at jimhanleyllc.com or call me at 623-3646. That's 623-3646. Jim Hanley LLC is a registered investment advisor and a member of FINRA SIPC.
Politics too often overrides sound policy decisions, and you pay the consequences. The Grand Canyon Institute, a centrist think tank, uses the power of independent thinking to rise above the political fray and subject policy ideas to economic analysis. The Grand Canyon Institute provides high-quality independent research to advance solutions to Arizona's biggest problems, whether it be education, water, tax policy, healthcare, or jobs. Check out the Institute at GrandCanyonInstitute.org. Read our policy reports, join our email list, or donate.
We're coming on back right now, Pima County, in a beautiful, beautiful afternoon today. The sun is out. The weather is just delicious. It's finally not 197 degrees outside and sweltering. Dave, are you on with us?
Yes.
Good. We're back here. Connect Learning to Life. We have our friend Dave, and Dave Wells is with Grand Canyon Institute, and we're talking a little bit about, and an ASU professor, talk a little bit about Proposition 208, bringing in about $800 million, was projected somewhere around $900 and some million, call it a billion. But boy, it's going to be great educational dollars. Dave, what happens when we get have we ever seen anything like this in Arizona, an initiative like this?
Well, it's not too different in terms of the revenue piece of it from Prop 301 that we had on the ballot in 2000. Because Prop 301 is the 6/10 of a cent sales tax that was recently renewed by the legislature for another 20 years. So that's good to 2040. So it brings in about the same amount of money as that. But the challenge has been that our legislature hasn't been very good at funding education outside of this. So Prop 301 had a guaranteed inflation increase, and the legislature during the last recession refused to grant that. And that led to a lawsuit, which led eventually to Prop 123 and the use of some of our state trust land dollars to help fund things. But that actually, the amount of dollars that K-12 should have received wasn't exactly the amount of Prop 123. It was sort of a compromise. So at least kids could get some money now, as opposed to have to wait many, many years and fight the legal battle much longer.
Gotcha. Do you see this as an opportunity where the legislature might say, hey, since you got your proposition, we're not going to fund any more education?
I don't think so. I mean, it's always possible that, you know, they'll do the minimum possible things. And one of the issues that we're going to run into in this next legislative session, depending on how the legislature approaches it, is when we did approve Prop 123, we allowed the legislature permission that if revenues go down, that they don't have to increase education funding. So it bypasses the essentially the inflation increase that was required under Prop 301. So we may run into that, but in general, though, when the funding goes continues, then they have to sort of continue to increase the funding. So so they're not going to, I don't think they're going to, it's always possible that they won't increase it as much, but they have to still reach that minimum inflation base thing. And when the economy recovers, they have to continue doing what they would have done otherwise. So I think, you know, that part, it's pretty well protected. And this will hopefully target a key area that we've really had challenge with, which is finding good teachers, because teaching is not an easy profession. It's actually much more difficult, as your last guest showed right now, trying to be, you know, both. Some teachers are—they're trying to teach, you know, kids in person as well as online at the same time, and it's just—it's a really draining and, you know, challenging thing that a lot of teachers are going through. And Prop 208 is really well designed in terms of hopefully providing enough incentives to not only increase teacher pay but also enable people who want to go into teaching to be able to go into teaching tuition free, that they can get really good scholarships to encourage that, as well as there's money for mentoring, which I think is really critical, as you probably know, in terms of it takes, you know, good teachers about 3 to 7 years to really become really good teachers, and it's not something you can do easily, and there's issues related to classroom management, and having an experienced teacher who can maybe take one class out or two classes out to be able to work with some of these new teachers can really be, you know, really, really helpful in terms of them being more successful and staying in the profession.
You know, as Lauren, our last guest, talked about kind of being on that island or feeling isolated, one of the things that other teachers have spoken about a lot is obviously the teacher pay and the conditions and the environment, which is a big thing, but also just that support system of those mentors. I think you're absolutely right on that. I think this is a phenomenal initiative. Where do we rank right now as far as educational funding in the state and compared to the nation?
Yeah, I haven't looked it up recently. I mean, we've always been low. We haven't always been low. I mean, there was a time in the 80s when we were sort of the middle of the pack. We've been in the, you know, 48, 49 out of 51 for some times. And now our outcomes are better than that. So people who, you know, push back that, because our teachers do a pretty excellent job with a very diverse kind of student body, given the very minimal resources we provide them. So some of the states that, you know, also fund their education very poorly are like Idaho and Utah, but they have much more homogeneous kinds of students, and they have much more intact families. So they don't nearly have the kind of challenges that the teachers in Arizona face with trying to help students be successful.
Well, I think anything that we're going to do and help these teachers out and help our educational system is what is desperately needed, especially with our teacher working the way they are and just the environment that is out there. Now, we had a nice day on November 3rd, and we have a new administration, the Biden administration. And one thing that does change when a new administration comes in is the Department of Education, and Betsy DeVos will be gone. So what is that going to do, in your opinion?
I'm not on the Betsy DeVos fan club, you know. I'll be glad to see her packing her bags and leaving. She's been really pushing private schools. You know, she doesn't emphasize a lot with the public schools, and you know, the issue with, you know, private schools is they have very little accountability. They're allowed to discriminate about who attends their school within reason, and they can also teach. Like in Arizona, there's really no limit to what they can teach. So, and a lot of them are religious. So, you know, they can teach, you know, creationism and teach evolution is wrong. And there's nothing wrong with that in terms of the way the state does that. And it's sort of, the issue that here in Arizona, we provide huge subsidies to private schools. And Betsy DeVos is a big fan of that. And we've been a critic of that because we basically in Arizona, private schools actually have not seen an increase in enrollment, but we've thrown more and more public dollars at private schools just on the basis of choice. It's different than charter schools, who have a lot of accountability, not as much accountability as we'd like to see, but they have a lot more than private schools do. So it'd be good, I think, to see somebody who is a professional educator as opposed to whatever you want to call Betsy DeVos in the Department of Education.
Well, it's going to be an interesting thing. If you, I mean, just a guess personally, who do you think Biden would pick? Is there a name out there or anyone that has been discussed?
I have to pull that one up because I know that there are people speculating about that, and I don't have that in front of me. So, I just know it'll be. Well, I did see one list. And again, I don't know who he's going to pick. And you have to keep in mind, whoever he picks has to be confirmed by the Senate. And, you know, barring the Democrats winning both Georgia Senate seats in the runoff in January, which is going to be a really tough thing for the Democrats to pull off, you're talking about a Republican-controlled Senate. So in that case, of course, you could get, you know, people like Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins from Alaska and Maine, respectively, who might, you know, cross over. But anyway, Randy... I think Weingarten, the former head of the American Association of Federation of Teachers, I think is one of the people I saw on the list. And so the question is, you know, whether or not, you know, people like that could get through the Senate. So I'm not sure. I mean, he's going to have to sort of think through that dynamic. It's a different dynamic than what Donald Trump faced because he had a Republican-controlled Senate, but he was also a Republican.
Well,
or Obama faced when he in 2008.
It would just be nice to have a better relationship with our federal partners and then the state and down into the local. Let's switch gears here for just a little bit. As we spoke to Lauren, she's teaching at TUSD and you're teaching at ASU. How's it looking in the colleges right now? What's that landscape look like?
So we teach synchronous. So in the sense that we've got students in the classroom, social distancing and on Zoom at the same time. And I teach two classes in American government that way. One is a small class. It's an upper division class with only 12 students, and the other is a big class that has about 100 students. At the beginning of the semester, we had about half the students showing up in person and half on Zoom. And now we're seeing my 12-student class has zero students typically showing up in person. They're all on Zoom. And the class of 100 students typically has, we typically have about maybe 10% of the students who, give or take a little bit, show up in person, and the rest are on Zoom. And then with Zoom, we record all the classes. So the way I have it set up, I have one student taking the class from India who's 12 and a half hours different. So that student has to go by recordings all the time. And then I put all the things, we use a software thing called Top Hat, and I put everything into homework mode so they're able to, if they miss class, they can listen to the things and they can go through everything we did within the next 24 hours and still get credit for the things that we did. And it also helps them review it. It's nicer when you see students in person because you can sort of, like, I can't tell the names of the faces of the students in the student class because it's too big.
Everyone's a screen these days and a number now, right? I mean, it's this connection of the one-on-one, face-to-face, just in person. I mean, we're sitting here in the studio right now, and it's just nice to be next to Nathan and my brother from another mother, Justin Williams, over here. But what about the social-emotional aspect for our college kids and our college professors?
So in a big class like that, I don't think I'm able to deal with that as much because it's really up to the students. Because, you know, the Zoom screen, I can't teach the class and see all the students at the same time. You know, Zoom just shows you a little subset of it, and I'm sharing a screen most of the time in class. And even in breakout rooms, which we'll do pretty regularly, we can't pop in them that often because it takes a while to go pop into a room another. The 12-student class is really easy to keep track of because it's so small, and we have really good discussions, and we're able to connect with students, and if they have issues, they can bring it up and they don't feel, you know, intimidated or anything like that. So that one has a really good environment with it. But yeah, large classes, I think it's really really, it's never easy with large classes to keep track of students, for students who, you know, can fall through the cracks and stuff like that, especially in college where you're expecting students to take a little bit more responsibility and a little bit less hand-holding than you have in the K-12 system. But with Zoom, it, you know, they can, you just, you don't even see them. So it's hard for me to, because I can't learn students' names the way I would normally, because I would sort of, I could be teaching class and I could look at everybody's face, you know, and look back at the roster pictures that I've got and eventually try to, you know, between that and meeting with students in small groups, get to know people. It's just really hard and to impossible, at least for me, to do that in a large class. So I can't get to know the students in the same way.
Well, I think it's really interesting that the same feelings are there, whether you're a professor, you're a second grade teacher. I mean, the feelings and caring about our kids and our students, it's so important. Dave, we're going to get you back on another time. I want to thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. I want to dig into that mind a little bit more in another segment. Maybe we'll get into some charter school and district school and look at some more funding so the public can see it. You, thank you very much, Dave. You are live today, Pima County. We are here. This is our show, Connect Learning to Life.
Politics too often overrides sound policy decisions and you pay the consequences. The Grand Canyon Institute, a centrist think tank, uses the power of independent thinking to rise above the political fray and subject policy ideas to economic analysis. The Grand Canyon Institute provides high-quality independent research to advance solutions to Arizona's biggest problems, whether it be education, water, tax policy, healthcare, or jobs. Check out the Institute at GrandCanyonInstitute.org. Read our policy reports, join our email list, or donate.
Hi, my name is Jim Hanley. I was born and raised in Tucson, and I raised my own boys here. I want to get to know you, your dreams and goals, and help you shape them into a plan for success. I've been helping hundreds of Tucson families do this since 1993. It takes experience and know-how to navigate the rocky shoals of the financial markets and keep you on an even keel. I look at every account I manage every day to find opportunities to grow your nest egg, to make you at ease and enjoying your life. I want to show you the highest integrity and reliability you can find anywhere. That's why I named my business with my own name, Jim Hanley LLC, and why I'm a member of the CFA Society of Tucson. Find me at jimhanleyllc.com or call me at 623-3646. That's 623-3646. Jim Hanley LLC is a registered investment advisor and a member of FINRA SIPC.
We are back, Pima County. We are here for you. Connect, learn to life. Learning in life. Isn't life all about learning, Nathan? What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you stop learning.
I don't think so either. Matter of fact, I learn something every day. Hey, congratulations to myself and my wife. It's our anniversary, so if she's out there, happy anniversary. 11 years of pure love. Just pure love. Hey, we've got a great guest right here. His name is Justin Williams. He's the entrepreneur of the lifetime. He built Startup Tucson, but he's got something really neat that he's doing, which is the CivX part of the segment of the show where we actually do a little bit of learning, and he's got an essay that he's going to kind of teach us about here, and this is a part of the show that's really unique. So Justin, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you and tell us what we got, and let's hear this essay.
Thanks, Dustin. This is the first week we've done this, so bear with me. And we'll hopefully be doing it every week if we can continue this. So CivX is a project I'm building out to help develop and strengthen civic engagement and innovation. And each week I'm going to focus on reading an essay that I developed.
Okay.
So here we go. June 6th, 1944. Normandy, France. D-Day. 156,000 American and Allied soldiers risked their lives to protect democracy, defend our nation, and the entire world from the tyranny of fascism, the Nazis, and the Holocaust. As the years pass, the vivid details of World War II and the sense of civic responsibility have faded from our nation's social memory. The word fascist has become so widely used on social media that it has lost nearly all of its meaning. People call each other fascists when they really mean bully. But the real fascism is a far-right, authoritarian political movement that emerges when a dictatorial leader seeks to concentrate political power in their own hands. They then work to unify right-leaning religious and corporate elites with traditionally left-leaning populist movements that are built on a shared fear of national decline. Fascist leaders like Adolf Hitler use powerful propaganda campaigns to trigger national feelings of humiliation, victimhood, and cultural resentment. This helps to undermine public faith in the value of democracy, cultural diversity, and human rights. Then they demand expanded powers in order to restore national greatness. They celebrate militant nationalism, prioritize cultural and ethnic purity, and suppress political opposition through the use of corruption, cronyism, and fraudulent elections. Finally, they eliminate the essential checks and balances and level attacks on the universally trusted institutions essential to protect democracy, like science, journalism, and the courts. Free elections are often seen as the defining element of a healthy liberal democracy. But whether it comes in the form of a UK-style constitutional monarchy or an American-style democratic republic, free elections alone do not ensure the future existence of an enduring democracy. American democracy at times feels completely unnatural, perhaps because it is. To exist at all requires a set of cultural and social preconditions to take hold. And to endure, it requires citizens to take care to maintain these conditions over generations. Democracy requires a wide range of preconditions to thrive. Among these are a belief in the importance and ideals of democracy, a commitment to peaceful transition of power, an educated citizenry that values truth and applies knowledge, a culture that values political, individual, and economic freedoms, a willingness to become the loyal opposition after losing power, a tone of tolerance and civility in our public debates, a fair and equal application of the law, and a shared loyalty not to any specific policies, but to the democratic process itself. In short, liberal democracy is the antithesis of fascism. Here in America, representative democracy is baked into our national DNA. We fought a revolution for the freedom to establish a nation based on it. We came together to draft a constitution designed to protect it. And we have spent generations building a culture that honors our need to defend it. In 1984, on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, President Ronald Reagan recognized the sacrifices of those 156,000 soldiers by saying, quote, "Some things are worth dying for. One's country is worth dying for, and democracy is worth dying for, because it's the most deeply honorable form of government ever devised by man." Those soldiers on that day knew that we must defend democracy because it won't defend itself. They risked their lives to defend democracy. It was the ultimate act of citizenship. Nearly 80 years later, our world has changed dramatically. We are living in an era often called the Age of Accelerations, where the power of technology is accelerating at an almost unimaginable rate and driving powerful changes politically, culturally, environmentally, and economically. We all now live in a world that is multicultural and globally distributed, socially connected and hyper-competitive, digitally powered and always personalized, and rapidly changing and constantly disruptive. While these new innovations are solving old problems, they are also rapidly transforming society, often faster than people and cultures can adapt. The next grand challenge facing society today is that people and our civic structures tend to adapt to change slowly, while technology is pushing us to adapt at an exponential rate. We are living in an era of dramatic change, driven in large part by globalization and technology-driven innovation. These are the same conditions that led to the rise of fascism nearly 100 years ago. We are seeing the same resistance to change, the same concentration of wealth and resources, and the same distrust and fear among people. It's also leading to the power grabs using the same techniques of hypernationalism, the scapegoating of others, an increasing support of violence and militarism, rampant cronyism and corruption, and concerns over fraudulent elections. Just like in the early 20th century, this rising fascist movement is threatening the survival of our democracy. Why do we keep coming back to the same cycles of rising authoritarian threats? In part, it's because power feeds on itself, and it compounds, and it justifies the expansion of power. And it's also, in part, because representative democracy has a unique vulnerability. It requires constant effort to maintain this unnatural balancing of forces. And unlike in the past, our society is struggling with declining civic health, including social disengagement, falling rates of volunteerism, declining participation in community organizations, and flagging trust in public institutions. We struggle to form close relationships with our neighbors, but we easily descend into shouting matches with people on social media. So how does one defend democracy from these threats and challenges? The National Conference on Citizenship has launched an initiative calling for a national movement of civic renewal, saying, quote, civic health is an essential component of a vibrant communities, of strong democracy, and of individual well-being. In order to disrupt trends of disengagement and meet this current moment in American society, an immediate and robust effort is needed that can renew our sense of shared values and responsibilities as American citizens. A renewal that is partly about personal responsibility and partly about collective opportunity. Civic renewal means making a commitment to become a more active citizen or civic leader in our local communities. To ask yourself one simple question, four words, what should we do? What should we do to repair our civic relationships? What should we do to grow a stronger economy? What should we do to build a healthy community? Civic renewal will happen. We will choose to make it happen. We make it happen by committing ourselves to more actively staying informed, participating in democracy, voting, building community, and growing our social engagement. So as part of my effort to help grow this movement of civic renewal, I'll be hosting the Civic segment here on KVOI each Saturday. And each week, we will end with the Civics Five. Five ideas for you to do to boost civic engagement and strengthen democracy. And here are this week's Civic Five. Consider subscribing to a daily or local newspaper, because journalism is a core foundation of democracy, and these institutions are struggling to maintain their business models. Look forward on your calendar to the next election and mark it down. Look up your city council ward number and call the office to share your views on local issues you're about that you care about. Join your neighborhood group on Facebook or on Nextdoor. Look for a documentary on an issue you care about and invite your friends to watch it with you. These may seem like small actions, but when you take these small actions, and we start to all take these small actions, we build the fabric that is our civic society, and it's the very thing that maintains the long term our democracy in America.
Come on, put it together for it. So often we hear so many people talk about what do we do, what are we going to do, how are we going to change, what's going to happen? And really, it's about the action.
Yep.
That's what it is. And first of all, to all the military people out there that are, we want to thank you for your service and what you've done for this country, because it is so important. And Justin, giving us that last segment there is, you know, it's kind of touching, because too often we don't take time to learn, right? And take that moment. And so everybody got a piece of that today, and the theme behind it, what will you do? Now there's some actionable steps, and that's really important for our people out there to understand. I want to thank you very much for giving us that segment. We look forward to hearing that segment every Saturday. We also look forward to seeing everybody back in the airwaves next Saturday between 4 to 5 for the show called Connect Learning to Life. I want to thank all the sponsors, and if you'd like to sponsor, call us up. And for the guest, Lauren Lombardo, Dave Wells, and my brother from another mother, Justin Williams. This is Dustin Williams, the Pima County School Superintendent, and my sidekick,
Nathan Bacall.
Have a great afternoon and go enjoy the beautiful weather.
KVOI Cortero, AM 1030, the voice of Tucson. Trusted local news and talk. A Bustos Media Station.
is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.